This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
It's something they termed the Shimmer. We've sent in drones and teams of people, but nothing comes back. But something has.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are joined by a very special guest who Adam will introduce shortly. As always, we'll go over some news first. We'll tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts. And then we'll get stuck into the science that this movie brings up, including, amongst other things, the concept of horizontal gene transfer, what might be causing the awesome colour effect, ecological disturbance, and hybridization in the movie Annihilation, which I forgot to mention at the start. So, yeah, we're covering Annihilation, by the way. By the by, that's the movie. 2018's adaptation of the Jeff Vandermeer novel of the same name. As always, this show is broken up into a few different segments. There'll be time codes below, so you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. But before we get stuck into that, we have another doctor on the podcast today, so I will title all of us correctly. My name is Dr. Sam Perrin. I am a freshwater/invasive ecologist and climate analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside co-host Dr. Adam Harsick, a parasite/disease ecologist at the University of Arkansas. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, also known as Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. I've made that dumb joke about your full name being Elizabeth so many times that it's just...
Habit.
Yeah. Well, that is her full name, so...
And as every week, we're joined by Dr. Dave, who is a vet and our movie physiologist. And we are joined by a fifth member this week. Adam, would you like to introduce our special guest?
Absolutely. This week we're joined by Dr. Kirsty MacLeod, a behavioral and evolutionary ecologist at Lund University in Sweden, a place near and dear to my heart. Kirsty's work focuses on how the environment that a species grows up in can affect its development, including how a parent's environment before its offspring's birth can affect its behavior and growth. This is particularly important because it tells us a lot about how our own actions can affect not just the animals around us, but how our actions can affect multiple generations of those species. Kirsty also runs the Women in Ecology and Evolution podcast, which highlights the work of fantastic researchers across ecological disciplines, as well as going into some of the less research-based sides of science. One of the favorite parts of these episodes is the roundtable discussion towards the end, and if you want a good episode to get started on, I would highly recommend the episode Not Sticking to the Science, mm-hmm. which features a great discussion between Kirsty Graham, Charmi Sen and Martha Munoz on the relationship between science and politics and scientists as political beings. And, fun fact, Kirsty was one of the scientists featured in the most recent series Alien Worlds. As a podcast that talks a lot about speculative ecology, it was really fun to see Kirsty's work with meerkats being related to big, flubbery sky manta rays. Check out episode 1 if you want to meet Kirsty in person, quote, quote. Kirsty actually wrote one of the first papers that I wrote up for the blog Ecology for the Masses on the fact that even local predators can't attack a species, just the presence of those species can cause the species to drop dead. Kirsty, we talk a lot about terrifying creatures all the time on this podcast, so if you could maybe go into that research a little bit in more detail, we would very much appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's really great to be on the podcast. As you said, I primarily work on those kind of intergenerational effects, so how experiences that the mother goes through then passes on and influences the traits and characteristics and successes of their offspring. So the study that you mentioned was a study looking at how the predation environment influences offspring traits in snowshoe hares. And it was kind of funny how that paper came about, actually, because the experiment was designed to look at those transgenerational effects. So if snowshoe hare mothers were exposed to this predator during gestation, obviously it wasn't a real predator in this case. It was a trained dog that looked a lot like a wolf and smelled a lot like a wolf. So the hares were obviously scared of it as if it was a real predator. And then the idea was to then look at how those experiences influenced the offspring. But what actually happened was that very few mothers in the group that was exposed to the predator actually survived the treatment. So then it became a paper not so much about intergenerational effects, but about how the stress of predation can have these what we call non-consumptive effects on prey. So even though they might not eat the prey item, it then obviously stresses them to the point where they can just drop dead, even though it's not a predation event. So yeah, my work kind of has incorporated predator-prey interactions and ecological disturbance in looking at not just the effects that mothers have on their offspring, but then also how that kind of feeds into population dynamics and life history events, mostly in invertebrates. And I've since moved on to looking more at reptiles. So that was a brief foray into the world of the Yukon.
It's a really cool paper.
When Adam suggested getting on this podcast, I remembered that paper that Adam wrote up, and I thought, oh crap, I just bought a dog and I've got a guinea pig who I may have just shaved six months off the life of. But fortunately, she doesn't really seem to care that there's a dog around. The birds don't either. Like, the birds are terrified of our hands, which feed them all the time, but there's an actual predator in the room now and they don't seem to mind.
That's interesting.
So, strange.
Moving on to the news this week, Adam, you have a fascinating story that you want to share, right?
Yes, I do. I cannot remember this woman's name, so I apologize for that, but I was on Twitter just scrolling through all the various scientists and related to science people that I follow, and this woman's mother lives out in California, where the California condor, the very endangered bird that was recovered from the brink of extinction, lives in the wild. And there are about 160 to 180 of them living in the state of California in the wild, and this woman's mom sent her pictures and told her that 15 of these giant birds are now living on my porch, and they've trashed the place, and there's shit everywhere, and they tore up all my furniture. So these birds are enormous, and this woman, as she put it, her mother is very, very small, and she's just going out on the porch, just being like, shoo, please, just go away to these massive, massive birds that are just trashing the place. And to put into perspective these kind of numbers and how crazy this is, that is about 1/10 of the entire population just descending on this woman's house and trashing it.
Cinda Mickles is the name of the woman. And her daughter, Shauna Quintero, was the woman who put it all up on Twitter. These birds have a fascinating story behind them. There's a woman called Jan Hamber, Professor Jan Hamber, who basically dedicated her life to bringing these back from the brink of extinction. And there's also been some fascinating work done with Native American groups in their habitat to keep them alive. The images, if you go onto Twitter and go to @ShaunaLynn, Shauna spelled S-E-A-N-A, they're incredible. Like, just ruining this woman's house.
It looks like the aftermath of a frat party.
Exactly. Yes. That's exactly what it looks like. And just like the play-by-play updates were so wonderful to see. If like, update for my mom, the bird just circling the house ominously. More to follow. Just like, what is happening?
Oh, Otter, please don't do this.
We got news for you, pal. They're going to nail us no matter what we do. So we might as well have a good time. Toga, 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 toga.
So this week, we are looking at Annihilation. Like I said, it's based on the Jeff Vandermeer book. It was part of a trilogy. We'll get into some more kind of trivia on that in a second. So Natalie Portman is a biologist, formerly in the American Army, whose husband goes off, who is still in the Army, comes back from a very strange expedition and is violently ill, and she discovers that he's been caught up in this big kind of government, not conspiracy, but government. What do we call it when a government...
Cover up.
Which has been... the subject of which is this enormous kind of bubble of weird light that's spreading. They're sending people into this thing, which they call the Shimmer, or Area X, and nobody ever comes back. So she volunteers to go and join a team into said bubble, joined by four different scientists or military experts. A lot of weirdness ensues. There's some encounters with some very strange animals. There's also a giant faceless bear. I don't mean like faceless as in, you know, you don't really know what it's about. I mean, it's literally missing its face. Yeah, it's a really good film. It's a sci-fi kind of Adam, you classified this as cosmic horror, right?
Yes, this is what cosmic horror is.
Yeah, it's very much kind of the unknowable. They're all trying to figure out exactly what is causing this. And the theme of self-destruction is kind of the most prevalent theme. All the scientists or technicians who go into this bubble are all kind of engaged in some form of self-destruction. In any case, the most interesting trivia I think about this is that, like I said, Jeff Vandermeer wrote a trilogy, but Alex Garland started making this film just after the first book had come out. And he was actually really surprised at how many of the things he put in that first film ended up being kind of the same in the books.
Hmm.
It led to some really cool decisions, and I think it's a really interesting take on the book. It's not very similar to the book in terms of plot, but the overall tone is really similar. So I think it's a really interesting thing to do. Unfortunately, it did lead to Natalie Portman and Jennifer Jason Leigh getting cast as characters who were later turned out to be Native American and Asian. Which the book, the film copped a little bit of crap for, because Alex Garland specifically said, nobody tell me anything about the other books, because the second one came out when he was making this one. Ah. And so at that stage, I believe he'd already cast both Natalie Portman and Jennifer Jason Leigh, and I don't think he could have gotten out with it. But, I mean, it did come under criticism for that, which, I mean...
Totally fair.
You know, I think it's probably fair, but...
Did really love Natalie Portman in this role, but does not excuse whitewashing, obviously.
Yeah. So, who would like to start with what they liked about this film?
I'm happy to. I think
I
first watched this movie about 3 years ago, not too long after it came out. And I remember very much enjoying like seeing a more, quote, realistic portrayal of scientists in a movie and that kind of aspect of a kind of really unique take on horror and like a science fiction thriller. Upon rewatching, I was not as enamored by the portrayal of scientists or these characters in general. I didn't like it nearly as much. I guess I don't know if I was thinking about it too critically or if it was a matter of having different memories of what it actually was, but I recommend it as a movie, and it's really cool from the different design and aesthetic and soundtrack aspects. Like it's a beautiful piece of art, I think.
Okay. Kirsty, do you want to go next?
Yeah. I also first saw it when it first came out a few years ago and then rewatched it today actually. And, yeah, I think the same thing struck me both watches. It's visually so stunning. As Adam said, it's so, the soundtrack is fantastic as well. I liked it. I liked the plot a lot. It lost me a little bit in the last half hour. I think I felt like it was building up to something a bit more metaphorical. And then as soon as it got a bit more, I felt like the last half hour was a bit obvious. But the journey was fantastic, liked the casting a lot. And yeah, I liked seeing a group of female scientists in a movie. I thought that was cool. Generally liked it a lot. And it's definitely worth seeing just for the visual elements, I think.
Okay. So I really enjoyed this film. I was very happy when I heard that we were going to do this because I remember the first time watching it. I do think... Yes, I agree with some of Adam and Kirsty's points. There's some biological inaccuracies, but as a whole, I thought this film was really clever and it doesn't tend to like talk down to the audience. I just find it absolutely gorgeous in terms of the filmography, the soundtrack, the lighting, the creatures that they get to encounter are just so cool. The bear still terrifies me that we'll get into later, but man, do I love that thing. And, I really liked a lot of like the takes. I also like the timing, and we'll get into that later, that this is something like they're not saying the meteorite, spoiler alert, caused immediately all of these changes to take place. There's a really good timeline of like this is a slow, steady biological process. And I love the ending. My partner and I just finished rewatching this last night. And that the final interaction with the creature and the formation of the, again, spoiler, clone that comes out from the Natalie Portman with that sort of, I mean, that just felt like cosmic horror. I was actually watching this and my partner like pulled my arm and she's like, this is what Adam was talking about, right? The big thing that's like all folding in on itself and it looks terrifying. That's what he wants to see. And I'm like, yeah, this is what Adam wants to see. So no, I really liked so much of this film, and I really liked the casting. I adore Oscar Isaac.
The
entire cast did a fantastic job.
Yeah, this movie was aight. I think for me, I should clarify that I am not a big fan of cosmic horror. I think the reason why is I think while visually it can be very interesting and intriguing, and this movie did that well. I loved the visuals. I loved the plants. I loved the creatures. I thought everything was just like art design wise, fantastic. But to me, I feel like whenever you have that cosmic horror, because it is follows those strict regimes of themes, like the slow descent into madness, blah, 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 it can get a little tropey to me and predictable. And I felt like I knew the ending of this movie within the first 2 seconds of starting it.
Oh, okay.
So it was the journey for me was a little boring because I already knew where it was going to end up. For me, it was just like more about enjoying the scenery along the way.
I really like this movie. I think it's I've mentioned the book before, but I don't think you really need to read the book. I think this is one of the examples of a movie that's better than the book.
Hmm.
Like as Kirsty said, I think the score is amazing here. Like the movie is the music is so haunting, and I love the idea of an antagonist that is just kind of more curious than anything. Like if there is any form of sentience in there. I think you can only really say, hey, it's just kind of messing around, experimenting.
Ventress's line at the end where she says, you know, we don't know what it wants. In fact, we don't know if it wants.
Exactly, yeah. I think that's a really good summary of it, yeah. I think the theme of self-destruction, whilst it's a little kind of, you know, banging you on the head with it a couple of times, I think it's done quite well. As I think Dave mentioned before, the ending's great. I love an ambiguous ending. I think you're supposed to kind of have an idea. Adam and I were talking about this. I think there's an implied ending, but you can interpret it in different ways, which is really interesting. Every time I've watched this, I've changed my mind on what the ending actually means. I really like that. And I mean, the scenery is incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, so some of us have already touched on this already, but what didn't we like about this movie? Adam, you want to start again?
Oh, I think I just disliked the... While this is a better portrayal of science in movies than we usually get, it's still falling prey to the same issues that a lot of these movies fall prey to, where they just throw around terms because they think it sounds good, but that's not how it works. You can't do it this way. You can't have somebody's intestines moving around their body like this and just be like, oh, it's a mutation. It's like, no, this dude's dying. Like, this is not right. And you can't. And this is something that so many movies have done. You can't just use a dissecting microscope to watch cell division happen on. That happens on much too small of a scale to be able to see in that way. In a portable dissecting microscope. First off, where's her power source? Does it have batteries? That's not how this works. But I think that, and then Kirsty sent through a really good article on how these scientists communicate to each other, and so I want to let her, I'll leave that for her to touch on, but more issues with the science and how it's treated, even though it is a better representation than we usually get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kirsty?
I'm not sure that there was anything that I particularly disliked. I think the story just slanted off in a direction that I hadn't really expected so much. I think from the first hour, I thought that it was, we've talked a bit about the theme of self-destruction. I thought it was going to be much more about anthropogenic change and how humans have destroyed the planet rather than a meteor. Again, spoiler. So initially, a lot of the crazier mutations are around places of habitation. And so I was really building up for it to be kind of more of a metaphor. So when it became kind of like, oh, she's fighting against literally herself, I did think, as Libby said, that became a bit tropey. But otherwise, I generally like Natalie Portman's character, but I did have some questions about her timeline that just kept annoying me. Like she'd spent 7 years in the military and then somehow made professor at Johns Hopkins by the time she was about 30.
I didn't even think of that. Yeah. 7 years in the army. Yeah. Because, I mean, she's made, even if she hadn't been in the army, she's made professor very quickly.
And I also thought it was funny that like she's the designated biologist. So then everybody just expects that she will know everything about all of the biology. Like, obviously, I work on reptiles and have worked on mammals. I don't know every single, I can't ID every single reptile or mammal or bird or tree.
Yeah, I guess similar to the points we're going to get into, the microscope, certain aspects of like the scientific approach, I definitely felt the pain of my, like I before I became a veterinarian, I was obviously doing biology in academia and did graduate work beforehand as well. And my partner will be walking through the woods and she's like, what kind of tree is that? And I'm like, I don't know, probably birch, maybe. Don't ask me these things. I will say that I also had little things that like I got laughed at last night. So example, Natalie Portman is wearing her backpack completely correctly. She's got the straps done up and like all the weight is like tight on her chest. Oh, and I was like, God. Oh, that's really cool. And then you see the other like women walk out and the backpacks are sort of like hanging loosely off them. And my partner was like,
oh, Adam pointed that out too.
They're not supposed to be military trained. And I'm like, someone would have trained them how to strap their backpack before going in. Or Natalie Portman would have walked up and been like, come here. I gotta, and tightened everything properly. So I had some like moments where I was like, eh. And I mean, we'll get into some of the biology in terms of how it doesn't work, but there's still way more I love about this movie than don't.
Libby, I feel like you've already
well, I was just gonna,
on this movie a bit. But
I was just going to add further. To me, I think I have a problem with movies that try too hard to be intellectual. And I think while this movie didn't completely do that, a great example of a movie that does that is The Lighthouse with Willem Dafoe and Rob Pat Bat. That movie is visually bananas and just absolutely brain melting to watch. Don't ever watch it.
Okay.
Or do, I don't know, whatever your bag is. But I felt like this movie was like getting too close to that line for me, where I was like, are you trying too hard to be like a little heady with the conversation you're having with the audience?
I didn't have too many problems with this movie. I think there are obviously problems with some of the ways the scientists behave, but it's so much better than what we normally get that I was like, you know what, I can deal with this. Like, there is a point at this in this movie where somebody actually tests a hypothesis, which doesn't usually happen in a movie. Somebody just usually comes up with a bananas theory and everyone's like, oh yeah, that's what's happening.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And there was, look, I can't empathize with this. I can't empathize on a deep level with this at all, but there were some criticisms of Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, the fact that she had, quote unquote, movie cancer. Like, a person has cancer, so it means, you know, everything, they just give up and that's it. Whereas the reality is that lots of people, like, live with cancer on a daily basis. It is a struggle, but it is like a portrayal of movie cancer. It's just like, oh, she has cancer, so she's given up. That's it. Yeah. Again, this was, I'm picking at straws. No.
What? Grasping at straws?
Yeah. Grasping at straws here, because I really don't, there's nothing I really dislike about this movie. If I could make one criticism, it's that I like everything in this movie, but there's nothing that I particularly love, apart from maybe the score. Okay, so before we get into the science of the movie itself, if you've got any thoughts or questions about any of the films we've done, or this film in particular, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at SamPerrinNTNU. Adam is at ArsicAdam. No, what am I talking about? I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. What am I saying?
Come on, Big Dr. Fishboy.
Adam is at ArsicAdam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can also find us on Twitter at @C_Animalia. You can visit our website, www.cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit www.shortstorysoup.substack.com, and you can sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. If you want to get in touch with Dr. Kirsty MacLeod, you can find Kirsty on Twitter at @KirstyJean. Jean spelled J-E-A-N. And you can find out more about the Women in Ecology and Evolution. Women in Evolution? Shit. Ecology and Evolution. Women in Ecology and Evolution?
Yeah, that's the arbitrary order I decided on.
You can find out more about the Women in Ecology and Evolution podcast at the_we_podcast.
Yeah, or thewepodcast.org.
Of course, as always, if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam and I write about, you can check out www.ecologyforthemasses.com. And if you want to read more about Kirsty's research, you can go to kjmacleod, M-A-C-L-E-O-D, .weebly.com. Cool. Okay. So the first thing we wanted to do is, I mean, one of the big one of the big pluses of this movie is the visuals. And one of the aspects of that is the shimmer itself, the way it looks. It's a really haunting first impression. And Dave, you've actually got some thoughts on why it looks that way, right?
Yeah. And so do they touch on why it looks that way in the book?
It doesn't. The book is very much a kind of like, oh, this is all indescribable and weird and horrifying. Cosmic horror, as Adam put it. So it's, yeah, the book is slightly different in terms of how everything looks.
Well, for those of you who have not seen the movie and listening to the pod, imagine a giant Dawn soap bubble.
A giant what?
Like Dawn dish, like soap. A dish soap. Like dish soap. Soap bubble.
Oh, yes. Gotcha.
Yeah, and that's sort of the first thing that came to mind. So the bubble that they're basically heading to, which they know somehow the meteorite at the center of is sort of generating this ever-expanding area called the Shimmer. And they call it that because on the outside, it seems to be giving this sort of multicolored appearance that doesn't actually create a physical barrier. They're able to step through it without much of a disturbance. And the thing that it kind of looked the most like when I saw it was gasoline on top of water, where you spread it out and it creates that sort of typical multicolored shimmer pattern. Now, just as a sort of brief overview, light, in terms of the way that color works, right? So a beam of light traveling containing all of the wavelengths that are associated with different colors comes from our sun, strikes an object, and basically absorbs all of the colors except for whatever color that object is. That particular wavelength is then reflected, strikes, you know, our eyes, and gives us the concept of color. That's where we get our reds, our blues, or everything else. Now, the way that that effect works when it comes to gasoline dripped on water is basically it strikes, it creates changes where the gasoline is made up of a whole bunch of different things. There's alcoholic compounds, there's organic, they're inorganic, and they spread out unevenly on the water. And when that happens, they create basically these high points and these low points, where in some areas it can be only a couple of molecules thick, and in other areas it's a little bit thicker. And it's just because the separation has occurred because some of the organic molecules that are present in the gasoline are hydrophobic. Now, when light comes and strikes the surface, a couple of different things happen. So some of the light reflects directly off the surface and basically that top layer of the petrol, but some of the light actually makes its way through down further into the water and then bounces around basically underneath, stuck between those different layers. Now, when that happens, some of the light comes back up quickly, some of the light comes back up slowly, and the way that the light waves as they're exiting, some of the light waves actually cancel each other out, and the canceled out light waves, whatever gets removed, we end up seeing only the light waves that are present that generate color. So you get a cancellation of a number of the different, let's say, blue or green or yellow waves, and all that gets left over is red that comes out. And since all of this is taking place, you're getting all this bouncing around with uneven color display, with some of it bouncing back at different points. That's where you get this generated color. And the phenomenon that this is known as is refraction. And it's, interestingly enough, a really cool hint that I hadn't even caught when they're going into the shimmer, because they talk later that, you know, inside of the shimmer, everything is refracting. Light's refracting, sound waves are refracting. And genetic changes are also refracting kind of in on themselves. And they're basically giving a hint right off the bat that this is what's taking place inside. Now, we'll get into the biology of why this might have happened. I struggle to kind of make this work, but as far as I can tell, the idea is basically whatever is causing this disturbance that's creating this ever-expanding bubble is allowing some new contents, most likely some sort of atmospheric change, to be taking place inside of the bubble. And as the material is expanding out, organic substances from our universe are striking against the outside part of this, and it's creating that distortion that we're seeing along the surface.
I think the simplest explanation there is just radiation. If it's coming from an extraplanetary source, like from space, there is usually some form of, I think the specific term, it might be a subset of radiation, is cosmic radiation.
Yep.
And the reason, one of the reasons we have an atmosphere is because it protects us from a lot of this cosmic radiation. That's UV radiation is one of the things that can get through and damage you. But if you're exposed to a high level of radiation, be it cosmic or otherwise, it can cause damage and or mutations to occur. So I think that makes sense for this movie.
I had the exact same thought, Adam, and I do think there probably is some aspect of some radioactivity from the meteorite, but it would have a barrier point. It wouldn't have this ever-expanding growth cycle that's occurring. So we'll get into my thoughts later. I think I have a mechanism I can kind of shoehorn in, not one that will resist any form of scrutiny, but something that we can at least say, okay, Dave came up with something.
Yeah. But this is, I mean, to move on to the next point, this... the concept is not only impossible because of, you know, those sort of limitations. It's not possible because you can't create an ecosystem where there's just constant radiation causing mutations in absolutely everything. Because everything's going to die. To be fair. There it is. Yep. these animals do look terrible. Like, everything looks incredibly unhealthy.
Except the deer.
Well, they look like deer? Because
I don't think they look all that healthy.
Yeah, they look very emaciated.
They're pretty emaciated. Yeah, they look very emaciated the way that they're reacting, and even the change in behavior, the two of them taking on the same pattern, I don't think they look healthy.
So I had a question about that, but to me, I think it's just a different bone structure, so they look slimmer, kind of like a greyhound versus a golden retriever. But my question with the deer was that supposed to be an example of a parallel to cellular mitosis? Because it looks like there's the one deer, and then, whoop, there's a second one, and it's doing the exact same thing. Was that supposed to be cloning itself in sight?
I'm wondering if we're seeing two that got too close to the lighthouse.
Yeah, and therefore created a clone or something.
I think that we're getting an early hint, but yeah.
Yeah, but to go on what we were saying earlier, that crocodile, even before it, alligator, sorry, because it's Florida, right? Yeah. Even before they start really just pouring bullets into it, it is, when it comes out of the water, it's bleeding, it's got sores everywhere, it's really, really unhealthy, and obviously the bear's face has fallen off. So
it's just a skull.
The crocodile smashes its way through the side of that building. Like, nothing physiologically makes that a good idea. Like, if every time Adam wants a sandwich, he just punches his hand through the side of the refrigerator, after a while, Libby's going to be like, so this is a door.
That's why we have the handle now.
Yeah.
This is not sustainable, Adam. We can't keep buying fridges.
He only does that when there's pizzas in there.
Or ice cream.
But even if, like, some of these animals did survive, they're under enormous stress. And Kirsty, you were saying earlier, like, subsequent generations would probably be horribly affected, right?
Yeah, I mean, that is something that we're starting to appreciate more and more, is just how much these stressors can then pass on to the next generation. I'm not sure what kind of stress response this level of radiation would induce. That's kind of an interesting idea, actually. But yeah, there's every indication that that would probably pass on to the next generation, if they are still capable of reproducing, which is a question that was not really answered by the film. I'm not sure that we saw any little baby animals roaming around with six eyes or anything like that. But that said, what we see in vertebrates is that a variety of different environmental stressors, like pollution, predation, even aggression from other members of the same species, they have very similar physiological effects, which tends to include, but is not limited to, spikes in certain hormones, which are crucial to the fight or flight response, but at chronic levels of exposure can lead to emaciation, the suppression of the immune response, and that sort of thing. So yeah, it wouldn't be an ideal stress situation.
So what you're saying is they should have made the gator just a nice cup of chamomile tea, just to, like, really mellow them out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, and Yacidi, light a candle.
I mean, think about, to your point about stress in the environment, if you haven't seen the HBO series Chernobyl, take a look at it, because it's wonderful. But also, they have some pretty, from my understanding, very accurate representations of what radiation poisoning does to a human being. And even a brief exposure will straight up melt the skin off your body, and it is terrifying.
So there are a couple of things that do kind of resemble what's going on here, very superficially. Adam and I took a microbial ecology, a molecular ecology class, which we did not like very much in our master's, course. And Kirsty, you didn't want to touch this either. So, Dave, I reckon we will handball off to you the responsibility of explaining what horizontal gene transfer is.
Sure.
I can help if you need it, Dave.
Awesome. Love it. So, obviously...
spiritual help. We'll pray for you. That's about all. Yeah.
Principles of vertical gene transfer we've talked about before, and I imagine is a big chunk of Kirsty's work, looking at the idea that organisms are changing over genetic material, basically down the lineage, parent to child. Now, when it comes to primarily unicellular, but very also small groups of multicellular organisms, there's another form of gene transfer. And the primary one is horizontal gene transfer. It sort of encompasses the big group. And we think of it, at least a lot in my profession, becomes very important for antimicrobial resistance, right? There is a problem that exists in both veterinary and human medicine right now that no one has a great answer to, which is, we haven't had any new antibiotics come on the market in 25 years, and we've got large groups of bacteria that we're finding that are literally resistant to everything that we have. Now, the three different methods that we normally break up horizontal gene transfer into are transformation, transduction, and conjugation. Conjugation being the one that Adam is going to make lewd gestures about and laugh his ass off. So transformation is the simple idea where basically, I'm going to use bacteria because they're my easiest element to do this. They come in contact with foreign material, so RNA or DNA, that's present on the outside of the cell, basically floating by. Think about it as you're stuck on a raft and you see something that you could use floating by and you decide to grab it and incorporate it in. So as this genetic material is traveling, usually from a deceased, but in some cases, actually bacteria can release these chunks of material to sort of trade from bacterial organism to bacterial organism. They pick this material up, they can take a look at it, and in some cases incorporate it into their own genetic structure in order to change or alter protein expression later down the line. Now, obviously for unicellular organisms, that can be really beneficial, and that's one of the ways by which they can pick up things like resistance to penicillin.
And that's the only way that those unicellular organisms can evolve, because a lot of them reproduce asexually. Asexual organisms reproduce clonally, so you have one cell and it splits into two, and now you have an exact copy of that second cell. Great in practice, because with sexual reproduction, you have to find a mate. Often, at least in vertebrates, that involves some kind of competition or even finding them first off, mating successfully, having our genes recombined to make offspring that are somewhat like both parents, but also still a different and unique organism in and of itself, which is good for responding to selection from the environment. Asexual reproduction has advantages because it's really quick, you don't need to find a mate. But because you have a clone of yourself, it cannot respond to any kind of selection in the environment. So if there is a parasite around and it's killing you, your offspring is going to be just as vulnerable to that parasite as you are. So with this horizontal gene transfer, let's say there's another bacteria in the environment that is resistant. You snatch some of its DNA, you put it into yourself. Now you're resistant to it as well, and so will your offspring.
Yep. Now, the second mechanism is transduction, which is basically just the process by which usually a viral organism carries over new genetic material and it's incorporated into the genetic structure of the associated organism, sometimes intentionally and sometimes accidentally. Sometimes the virus basically doesn't work the way that it's supposed to, and new DNA is able to be modified and taken in. And then the last mechanism, the one, as I said, Adam will giggle about, is obviously bacterial conjugation, where you find a situation in which two bacteria actually create almost like a bridge between them, and they're able to trade genetic material. There's a couple of different ways that accomplish it. Sometimes they can actually create little buds off of their own cell walls to try and transfer this information. But primarily, we think about it as bacteria sex, where basically they're connecting in such a way that there can be a transfer of genetic material that allows them to swap and basically take and borrow genes from one another in order to recombine into something new. Now, the mechanism that we're probably going to be focusing on, and we'll get into this in a little bit more detail as we go forward, is going to be transduction, is going to be kind of the only way that I can make this work going forward.
And if anybody wants to read like a really fascinating example of horizontal gene transfer, Lara Beckman, who writes for Ecology for the Masses, wrote an incredible piece on viruses and their influence on marine life. recently. Cool. And she talked a lot about how there's probably a lot of genetic information in the sea, which has been picked up from viruses, from marine viruses just floating around and like recombining with some of the organisms that they've gotten into. Yeah. So that, like I said, is called Viruses and Their Influence on Marine Life by Lara Beckman. So people check that out if you want an interesting example.
If I remember correctly, I think that there was a recent article in the last couple of years that a lot of our own human DNA has come from this kind of recombination with viruses and bacteria and getting material from them. So I think it's like 1/8 to 1/5 of our entire genetic material comes from other sources.
Really?
Well, I mean, we constantly reference the fact that eukaryotes potentially have a bacteria that just moved in. We think the mitochondria, in terms of the way that it keeps its mRNA structure, is just simply the neighbor who moved into your basement and was like, I'll pay you rent every once in a while. And you were like, you can stay. That's fine.
The mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah. Or the squatter in your basement.
I like the squatter in your basement who runs on a little hamster wheel to power your lights.
Right. Yeah.
I
mean. Yeah.
One of the two.
Okay. And then, so Kirsty linked us to this fascinating article that was written by two genomics professors.
Were they 30?
Say again?
Were they 30 years old as professors?
No, they. I can't. I don't want to judge. I'm very bad at judging age, but
that
I
may
will
be generous.
Put. I will say with a 98% confidence interval that these people are older than 30, a little. Pamela Silva and Jeffrey Way. They actually wrote a review as genomic scientists themselves and talked about horizontal gene transfer, which we've already gone into. But the other thing which we should briefly touch on is Josie Radek, played by Tessa Thompson, who I love seeing her in any movie. Talks about Hox genes briefly. And I'd never heard of these before. But Dr. Silva and Dr. Ray basically said, one of the scientists observed a set of bushes growing in human form and simply announces that Hox genes would be found in these plants. Hox genes are the master genes that control the body plans of animals, but they're not found in plants.
Duh.
So, yeah. And they actually point out that any, I'll quote this, any self-respecting biologist investigating the shimmer would carry a handheld DNA sequencer. And these really exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, look, as we'll get into a bit later, I still think these scientists are a lot better than most movie scientists, but yeah.
Well, in fairness, wasn't Tessa Thompson not a biologist?
She's a physicist. Yeah. I don't know why she's the one making these observations.
I mean, fair point that she was incorrect.
Right. And as a physicist, she probably would have also had a portable mass spec, which like you can definitely get. And I was like, she definitely would have wanted that.
Yeah, they're really cool.
I want one. Cool. I mean,
I should say this now. They've never, like, gotten anybody back from the shimmer. Why is nobody going and just, like, sticking an arm in and taking some measurements? It really annoyed me. Why are they not, like, tying a rope to anybody and just dragging them back? It doesn't matter.
Standing outside the shimmer with a rope tied around Eric. Throws a ball in there. Just go there, get that, and come right back.
Papa, I will, just do it, okay? You'll get some chocolate afterwards.
Yeah. All right. It's fine.
I had a question about that bit with Tessa Thompson. It was one of my favorite parts of the film. Again, so spoiler alert, she observes this body plan in these trees that make them look like people. So she insinuates that it's part of their new genetic makeup because of the refraction in the shimmer. But then she starts to grow bits of plants and she becomes a plant and it's very beautifully filmed. But those are kind of two very separate ideas, that either the plant is growing in a human body form or she is somehow assimilating genetic material 100%. From the plants.
It was muddled. And the way that Hox genes works is it doesn't mean those plants don't have a human body form, first and foremost. They are a tree that somehow looks like it has two legs, hips, a torso, arms, and maybe a head looking shape. That is still a plant body, quote-unquote, form, because it has bark, it doesn't have legs, it has roots and flowers. A human body plan is a humanoid with a torso, two legs, two arms, symmetrical bilateral symmetry, and a head.
Right. Doesn't it also have to start from, like, a gastrula or something? Yeah.
So, with the Hox genes, we read a paper on this semester in one of my classes, so I have a brief bit of experience with it. I'm by no means an expert, so if I'm wrong, that's why. But the way these Hox genes have evolved over time is you have, think about a decapod, something like a lobster, where it has a bunch of legs all down its segments, all the way down its body. And insects, which have six legs, have evolved blockers on their Hox genes. So where there was once something telling you to grow legs on this part of your body, that is now blocked, so they don't grow legs there anymore. They only grow legs in the thorax. Cool. So if there was a Hox gene on this in this plant, which there wouldn't be, they're animal genes, not plant genes, two completely different organisms, it would not be a plant that grows to kind of look like a human. It would be this bastardized like plant, like a mandrake in the Harry Potter movies, where it actually has legs, arms, and a head-looking thing.
Or an ant.
Or an ant.
Or an ant.
Check out episode 2 of Cinematic Animalia.
Yeah.
It's a good
episode. I also like the fact that, because we've talked about the fact that it looks like a human, but it's what somebody looking at a human with eyes would create. Like, the plant's not creating, like, vertebrae or bones. It's creating, like,
a silhouette.
The
silhouette.
Last thing that shows up when you look at a human.
A
like
loose outline.
Shadow.
You would think it'd have, like, you know, a vertebrae and a rib cage and maybe a skull if it was...
It also wouldn't create certain versions of them that are little kids.
Yes. Yeah. Horrifying.
Yeah, holding hands. Yeah. Like, yeah, but sure.
But I do agree with Kirsty. That was a really beautiful scene.
So
and
cool.
Like, the way that, because Josie Raddick in the movie, she is implied to be a, I don't know what the term is, but
self-harmer.
She's
self-harmer,
yeah. And all her scars is where the plant sprout from.
It's a beautiful scene.
Is it?
It's,
yeah, you watch her, she holds her arms up, and you get a quick glimpse of the flowers turning red as she crosses the corner, which means you can pick out which of them that she is in the pile of roses.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Adam, how did your... So we mentioned the Suriname toad last week. My wife also shares Adam's... Tryptophobia?
Tryptophobia, yeah.
Yeah. How did you deal with plants sprouting out of someone's skin?
From my understanding, tryptophobia is very specifically like circular patterns in a group, be they symmetrical or otherwise. So from hearing about The Invisible Man, for example, the recent movie, the suit is apparently very bad for people that have tryptophobia.
Ooh, yeah.
Because it's just dots after dots after dots after dots. So, like, in some of my field work that I've done that I did during my PhD, there were lily plants, which when the flower, the little bulb comes out, they have all these little dots in the middle of it. And I have a hard time looking at that one because it looks really gross to me.
Kirsty, where do you stand on the Suriname toad? As in, like, metaphorically,
gross.
Not where would you stand on an actual Suriname toad?
They're quite small. They're the ones where the babies pop out of the back.
Yeah, I love reptiles and amphibians, but that is gross.
Hey. She gets it.
Grossly amazing.
Okay, well, that makes us 3-2 this week, because Dave, Libby, and I love it. It just gives me such satisfaction.
Kirsty, I'm announcing to the biological council, and they're going to take your license away.
Oh, I don't know. It's a pretty hot debate, even in biology circles. I mean,
everyone has one animal that they think is gross. I'm allowed one.
We've talked briefly about ecological disturbance, and the fact that you can't have just constant radiation happening because everything's going to die. But what we wanted to explore was what would potentially happen if, as opposed to just constant like waves of radiation being sent out, messing with everything's genes and mutating everything. What would happen if you just had kind of one wave of radiation that hit everything? A little more like Chernobyl, although I know that area still is radioactive, where there were some really severe initial effects, and then those effects started to peter off. And as Adam mentioned earlier, Chernobyl's a fascinating example because you have had a massive amount of death. Mammal populations dove dramatically.
Probably because we killed them all.
The first couple of years after that happened. Yeah, yes. But in that time, everything's, like, grown back. Now, a lot of it, we don't kind of know how severely radiation is affecting these creatures because everything's kind of being affected on the same level, so it's hard to tell what's healthy in Chernobyl, whether that would be healthy outside of Chernobyl. But you do have, you know, a really repopulated area. Having said that, Kirsty, in this situation... That kind of stress of just, you know, the initial impact. How long do you think it would take before populations would get back to normal? No, I'm making quotation marks with my fingers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting idea. And what's cool from a physiological perspective is that one feature of the, at least the vertebrate stress response, is that frequently if mothers are exposed to a lot of stress, then what you get in their offspring is a slightly dampened stress response.
Yeah.
So it might potentially kind of better match them to a more stressful environment, or at least ensure that their hormone levels aren't just rocketing at the slightest disturbance. So I think in a physiological sense, things would probably get back to quote unquote normal relatively quickly. Because of course, having super high hormone levels or the other things that the stress response induces is not going to be sustainable down the line. And that's something that has obviously been kept relatively in check by evolution. But I think the idea of what's normal becomes interesting. I know we're all tired of the phrase the new normal, but I think in those sorts of situations, what you get is perhaps an altered population structure, which could then have effects on the trophic web, for example. So the kind of community structure of the ecosystem could start to change. So then what could quickly happen is that you may have fewer of some species, more of others, and then things might kind of settle into a new equilibrium. So again, it's the idea of what's normal outside that system may no longer be normal, but it doesn't mean that it's not healthy or functioning.
And it's interesting because, like you said, this sort of thing does promote biodiversity. You create like this spatio-temporal kind of area that's just been devastated. And then, you know, on top of that, the fact is that this disturbance event also creates genetic mutations, which further kind of improve genetic diversity. So, I mean, if things didn't die straight away, you might even see an increase in genetic diversity of species in the region as, you know, ones that didn't die reproduce and ones that were outside the crash zone kind of filter back in.
Yeah, absolutely.
If they could.
And this is the thing, like, that would only work if humans stayed out of there. And the initial pulse of, like, one radiative wave implies that humans could come back in pretty quickly. Although, I don't know, it does... Adam and Libby, you're American. You're from the South. I know that's a big place, but this is given the impression of something that looks fairly deserted anyway. Like, is the part of America they're supposed to be in, like, is there a high population density there in any case?
What does it say it is in the book? Because I was always under the impression this was either Louisiana or Mississippi.
I thought they said it was Florida.
Is it?
Am I wrong?
Do you know, Sam, does it say in the book where specifically Area X is?
May have, but I'm not sure. It is implied to be in a very kind of down and out area. I'm not sure if they mention it. Here we go. Let's see. The inspiration for Area X was a hike through St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge.
Pinpointed to the Florida Panhandle.
Yeah, I did a bunch of fence lizard research down in the Panhandle, Florida area, and it definitely reminded me of that area.
That is,
it looks very Floridian to me.
Okay. Unspecified coastal location that has been closed to the public. Yeah, this is another thing. In the book, it's been closed to the public for 3 decades. So it's been going for a lot longer.
Years.
And it's not expanding anywhere near as fast. Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, to answer your question, Libby knows more about Florida than I do, and she's been there a lot more. But in my experience of this area, yes, but...
I think it depends on what type of Florida. Panhandle, no. That's all developed.
Oh, really?
Anywhere with like beautiful oceanfront property like you see near the lighthouse, like,
right.
No, there would be so many condos on that thing. they still do have, obviously, the Everglades, but that is vastly disappearing as well, mostly due to Disney. Thank you. So it's very, very much encroaching on not having any kind of large wild space left in Florida.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. If you kept humans out of this area, I think you could, you know, with that level of genetic mutation that you supposedly see, potentially create some really not you. I mean, you wouldn't get shark crocodile hybrids, but I don't know. You might get a subspecies of plover come up, right?
You might, but I think the thing to keep in mind with when you have mutations, by and large, they do nothing. When they do something, it's usually bad. And the rare case of a beneficial mutation, it will take a long time, usually, to get fixed in a population for that then to become the, quote, new normal, as Kirsty was saying.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, like, if you have, you know, 100,000... Kirsty, you know more about plovers. I've chosen this specifically because I know you lost about plovers. In a coastal area like this, how many plover individuals do you think you would be able to get?
I guess it depends. Yeah, I'm probably gonna get shouted at by birders. You would get a couple of thousand, I reckon, if there was like a breeding colony on
that
beach.
So maybe, Adam, if you get two or three with like mutations that do something different and don't kill them, if you get, you know, a density-dependent effect when, you know, your other 998 plovers have died and you get, you know, more plovers coming back into the area, could those genes become, you know, fixed in a population?
Yes, which is actually really interesting to bring it to the Florida Panhandle, because there was an example not too long ago of anolis lizards. So those little green anoles we have here all over the U.S. and Central and South America, as well as North, Central, and I believe South America as well. Are you, Kirsty, if I remember correctly, are you in Tobias Uhler's lab? And
yes.
You work with those?
Yeah, I'm associated with Tobias's lab.
Okay.
But
do you know about this example that I'm talking about with the freeze and the quick selection changing everything?
Yeah, it's a super cool example, but I haven't done any work on that species myself.
Okay, so for the example I'm thinking of, in the U.S. not too long ago, we had a really big freeze during what is normally a warm area and a warm time of year. So Florida is, a lot of old people like to move there because the weather is always warm and it's tropical and paradise, blah, blah, blah. Condos on the beachfront, like Libby said. But when this freeze came through, a lot of the anolis lizards died because their reptiles are adapted for warmer climates. But some of them had either through plasticity or through just their genetic material itself, were able to tolerate those more extreme temperatures. So overnight, you had this incredible selection event and the entire population mean for a given trait shifted. Cool. So like Sam was saying about the plover example, you had this instantaneous overnight shift to a new normal. Obviously, there was a huge amount of genetic diversity lost because all the other ones died. But now you have this, quote, perfectly adapted population suited for this new normal.
Now, the only last and just poking quick hole in the theory is with the examples that Adam is bringing up and Sam briefly discussed as well for sort of rapid mutation. The big thing that's going to sort of handicap whether or not this leads to permanent change, if there was that big pulse that's associated with a horizontal gene transfer, is whether or not it affects the germ cells. Right. If your reproductive capabilities are not affected. Right. Exactly. So if sperm and eggs are not changed, you're expressing some type of physiological variation because it's caused you to redevelop your optic tissue or there's some new change that's taking over with auditory capabilities. If it's not leading to any change that's associated with eggs or sperm cells, then it's not going to be any trait that gets passed on.
And the other thing is, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, larger species. Even though plovers are very small birds, they're still larger compared to, you know, you're probably going to see some interesting mutations in insects, maybe beetles, maybe some plant life. But, I mean, you're not going to get hybrid species of bears.
Nope. Scream bear is not going to be able to reproduce. Thank fucking God.
Scream bear. Yeah.
So I wondered, obviously a lot is made of the fact that humans go into the shimmer and then nobody comes out alive. But does that also extend to animal life within the shimmer? So are animals, so say our hypothetical mutant plover, is it allowed to leave? Is it allowed, are others allowed to come in? Because that could influence whether mutations actually then end up being fixed in a population.
There's a really interesting bit in the book where they try to force like 100 white rabbits to go into the shimmer and the rabbits just won't do it.
Oh no.
And a bunch of the rabbits escape and they end up making white rabbits an invasive species in the area.
But yeah, to your point, Kirsty, I was thinking that's why the shimmer was expanding, because much like the issue with Chernobyl, to bring it back to that again, when that event happened, obviously everything in that area was irradiated to a pretty extensive degree. And the thing with radiation is that you absorb this radioactive energy, and when you travel, you're then radiating this energy yourself, and you can make other organisms, people, whatever, sick. So the governments went in and killed as many of those animals in that area as they could to keep them isolated in that area so they didn't spread any more than it already had. So I was thinking with the shimmer, the reason it, quote, could expand is if these radioactive animals or windborne pollen or that kind of thing are then expanding beyond the initial area.
Yeah.
So, Kirsty, your expertise, if it's fair to say, is in the stress physiology and the stress response of these animals, especially developmentally. And I know that I think about these things more in the evolutionary sense, but stress and the pathological response to an environmental stressor are two different things, right?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
So how does, from a developmental side, how do these organisms then, how does like change in the environment make sense? And how long do you think it takes to respond to the stress of this initial meteorite impact versus the long-term evolutionary and ecological change of the environment and the organisms to that environment?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I'm really not sure how radiation affects the physiology of the stress response. But if we were to treat it like any other environmental stressor, then I think because of this interesting feedback mechanism that results in offspring of parents with very high stress levels during reproduction, then themselves having a slightly dampened stress response, I think that would mean that quite quickly you would be able to, the physiological changes would be probably fairly short-lived. But something that my research is becoming more interested in is how those intergenerational effects affect not necessarily the long-term physiology, but perhaps long-term differences in behavior, like social affiliation, dispersiveness. And then those are things that very quickly actually could start to affect evolution if they affect the distribution of genetic variation and phenotypic variation.
Would that be kind of like saying that a parent lives in like the woods and they see a bear, like, holy shit, a bear. But then they're used to it. They become acclimated to it. And their kid comes along and they're like, oh, yeah, there's a bear. We live in the woods and there's bears. So stay away from it, but there's bears.
Yeah, it's this idea of they call it the kind of environmental matching hypothesis. So it's not necessarily to specific stressors, but to general levels of stress. If parents are experiencing a high general level of stress, then the offspring could potentially be kind of better suited to that, although it's not been very robustly empirically tested yet.
Okay, yeah. But we'll come back briefly at the end and talk about whether these are good portrayals of scientists. But for now, Dave, I want to hear your take on physiology in the shimmer.
Yeah, so we are Cinematica Animalia, which means no matter how batshit crazy it is, we always want to try and find a semi-plausible, I think I can make this work mechanism. So
for a bear, specifically for a bear without a face.
Before I make the bear without a face, I have to make something that is creating the changes that we're seeing. So I had the exact same thought as Adam did the first time I watched this. Meteor strikes. And so we need something that's causing rapid mutation. And we've talked about...
an alien that steals faces.
And we've talked about before...
Sorry, I'll stop.
That there are three different types of mutagen categories broadly. Radiation is the easiest and first one, the one that we talk about with Chernobyl, which meteorite striking hitting the Earth, giving off some type of cosmic radiation, could be creating alterations in genes, causing things to mutate. The problem is it doesn't expand, and it doesn't create an expansion that takes place over a slow process going over years, where we sort of get this big wide-scale change. So what I want to propose is that the meteorite was carrying something. I think that there's some type of organism that the meteorite basically deposited that has started to grow, is probably a small, either unicellular or barely multicellular organism that is terraforming. It started to produce its own type of atmosphere, and the atmosphere is spreading out. That's why we're getting this sort of slow growth. And I think that's what we see at the end of the film, where she climbs down and inside there's that little meteorite hole that's been made through the lighthouse, but then she finds this big sort of shelled structure that's growing out. I think that's our colonial organism. And I think that it just hit a really shitty spot. I think that of all the places that you're going to land on the planet, you hit an area of concrete and sand, and this poor little set of bastards is just trying to grow the best that it can and try to make itself work. Now, in the process, it's generating some type of atmosphere that we're capable of breathing, but is enough of a distortion to the outside world that's creating that organic barrier. Now, whatever the atmosphere it's generating has to be heavy because it's not expanding up. It's sort of staying close to the ground. And the second thing is the atmosphere that it's generating has to have mild chemical mutagenic properties, which are basically causing widespread mutation to take place. Now, that would be dangerous. It would be rather difficult. There are a whole bunch of different mutagenic compounds, and this is theoretically possible, I guess, that it's basically these organisms are producing and that that's why the bubble's slowly expanding outwards as it continues to terraform, working against the natural systems that we have that terraform our world. Now, that answers sort of half of the problems that I'm dealing with. I still think that there could be a cosmic radiation component to this that's basically creating some of the other distortions, because this runs me into my sort of final point, which is everything is evolving way too rapidly. So if we wanted something that's creating a mutagen that's getting taken in, sure, that works, but it doesn't explain horizontal gene transfer. So theoretically, we talk about organisms expressing ancient qualities. There's a big discussion about like vestigial organs or organs that, you know, we come with an appendix because it was something that was used in a previous organism, or that when embryos are developing, we pass through the stages that were associated with our ancestors, where, you know, certain species grow gills, even though they're going to be a terrestrial organism. Others develop tails that basically fall off, except for some poor humans who get stuck with vestigial tails. I'm sorry, Libby. And then that sort of problem going forward. Now, that works for some of the traits that we're seeing in this film, but a lot of the traits, like, you know, structures for shark teeth or for some of the adaptations that sort of the bear, the deer, or other organisms are taking place, they never shared that genetic heritage. There's no way they're falling back on old genes to express them because they were never there to begin with. So now we need something that's potentially allowing DNA to get moved from Sam and I over to Screen Bear. For that to happen, we need a virus. We need some type of viral organism that's picking up genetic material and shifting it between. It's got to be aerosolized, and it's got to basically be present, because there's no vector, there's no organism like a mosquito or a tick that hits all of the species that we see that would potentially be changing it over to the plants. It's got to be something airborne, and the virus has got to be mutating like a motherfucker, because it's hitting everything. It's hitting plants, it's hitting small organisms, it's hitting humans, it's hitting the bear. So it's got to be a combination of all three. There's got to be an organism that's terraforming, that's basically generating the chemical mutation. There's got to be some type of virus that it's brought with it. And that virus has got to be getting a shit ton of mutagenic properties from local radiation that's causing it to mutate in all kinds of different ways and affect every type of species that it can. This is the only way.
On behalf of everybody who listens to Cinematica and Amelia to escape their daily lives, I apologize that we're once again talking about airborne viruses that are, a threat to the rest of the world.
But, like, this is a common, bringing that back to what we're going through right at the moment. Although in my profession, we have found COVID a couple of times in dogs and cats, it's not a common occurrence because viruses are usually very specifically designed for one host. And the idea that a virus is affecting both Natalie Portman and the plants that are around her is insane. So, could happen, wouldn't happen. That's the best that I can put together that kind of makes this work. Now,
I think you've done a wonderful job.
Now, there's a couple of extra fun points that I want to get into this as it goes. So, larger organism changes, right? The bear is clearly having a really bad fucking time. I think that the bear, so the mutations that are taking place have led to half the skin falling off its face. The eye has fallen out of it. And clearly its neurological processes have been taking a beating. When it walks into the house and it's feeling around sort of trying to find a food source, and it's kind of tasting Josie, but it doesn't really know what's going on, and then it kind of wanders off, it's clearly having a bad time. That virus has clearly wreaked absolute havoc on its tongue to generate a human tongue, which would explain how it's able to make some of the human noises that are associated, but I don't think it would be taking memories over. I think it's just mimicry, that it's heard a noise and now it's replicating it over and over again as it finds itself with this new freakish organ growing out of its face. As we discussed earlier, the crocodile is having a bad fucking time. I do not think the crocodile is growing shark teeth. I think that the scientists are suffering from the effects of the shimmer, and they're like, oh, all the teeth are falling out like a shark. And it's like, no, all the teeth are just falling out. All the teeth are falling out. Skin is falling off it. Now,
I think it was more that it had concentric circles of teeth inside its mouth.
It looks like a lamprey's mouth toward back in its throat.
Yeah.
I worry they saw oral sores and they were like, oh, it's growing teeth. It's growing teeth. And it's like, no, it's just, it's, yeah. Now, And then the human, who I like to call Lichen Man, who basically gets spread over top of the pool.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I think he's had a parasitic organism. I think that there's been some type of rapidly growing lichen that's basically just pushed his body and his other fragments up that wall. I think
it looks
organs,
like a fungus.
Right. Mm-hmm. I worry that when they opened him up and they're like, oh, that was something inside of him. And they're like, no, it was his intestines. Adam is completely right. No, that was something inside of him. That was something that really shouldn't have been there. Now,
tapeworms gone.
I have no idea what would generate that. Now, the much cooler changes I found when we got closer to the Shimmer. Specifically, the one that like really stuck me were the glass trees that we see kind
Those
of like
so
standing
cool.
up. Now, yeah. I had no idea before watching this podcast, and I got reading way too much into it to the wee hours of the night. Do you guys know what diatoms are?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
It costs the shipping industry billions and billions of dollars every year because they grow on the bottom of ships. They're almost impossible to take off, and they slow ships down. Not by much, by like maybe a 12-hour journey becomes a 13-hour journey, but just that across the entire globe costs the shipping industry billions every year.
Yeah, they're beautiful. They're like the snowflakes of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. I have no idea how I have missed out on this for so long.
It's okay, Dave.
I mean, I'm
I was
going
to say, why don't you explain what they are anyways?
Yeah. So yeah. Diatoms are a major group of algae, and they're specifically a type of microalgae. So they're found in oceans, waterways, wet soil, basically the world. They make up a significant portion of our Earth's biomass, way more than I thought. And they account for approximately 20 to 50% of all oxygen produced on the planet every year. The really cool feature that makes them interesting is they're one of the only organisms in the planet that actually incorporates silica, sand, into making glass shells that protect themselves. And so these are organisms that actually have a glass exterior, which is really badass. Now I worry that as they're getting closer and closer to the lighthouse and basically where this organism is growing, the type of atmosphere that it's generating and terraforming is allowing organisms like the diatome, so unicellular organisms that are probably taking the changes in genetics and the rapid mutation way better, to grow like they are. And as a result, that's why we're seeing glass tree formation. It doesn't work on any cellular level, but I just worry the massive radiation that's going on. Or, and the more cool theory, is that this is more similar to wherever this organism is theoretically originating from. Which is why the minute that that shelled ship or core or whatever you want to call it under the lighthouse is destroyed, the glass trees collapse immediately. So I do think they're getting some type of atmospheric effect that's holding it up. And that kind of...
Interesting. So to me, I thought when I first watched it, I thought they were... to me, they reminded me of fulgurites, when lightning strikes sand and it creates those shapes. And I thought it had kind of mutated because of obvious the... being so close to the lighthouse, but I think that makes sense for me what you're saying.
Now, the last thing that I sort of wanted to get just briefly into were the clones that they run into, because they're so freaking cool and still give me nightmares. But obviously, Kane has been cloned. We get that right off the beginning. And I really enjoy that one of the problems we talk about with cloning all the time, there is a Russian company that if you give them, I think it's $20,000, will clone your dog for you. Or at least they claim they'll clone their dog. Or sorry, it's a Chinese company. Now, this is a terrifying phenomenon. But one of the things that people have had to be talked to about this, because we have had owners that have inquired and they've been like, you can clone my dog, right? And I'm like, no, dude. Like, we don't clone memory. Memory, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but memory is something incredibly unique. Now, the clones don't show those memory capabilities. They seem to be messing a lot with the information. Now, the really cool thing that I wanted to focus on is whatever these clones are, because we get to see them form the one for Natalie Portman. And it comes in and it's got that kind of silicated body structure to it. And this is kind of where I'm wondering whether or not these organisms are silica-based, because it responds to the bullets by basically they just kind of pass through and group out and kind of shift. But whatever material this organism that they try to make the clone of, and whatever that sort of big cavernous creature is, that colonial organism I think is growing under the lighthouse, they are flammable as fuck. Phosphorus grenades usually do exactly what we see with the first Kane, where he kind of grows, but that first clone thing will not stop burning. When Natalie Portman lights up the clone, like, it stands there on fire, shedding fire for a really long time. And when it gets down under the lighthouse, that place goes up, which there are apparently interesting silica combinations that you can make that are really flammable. So if this organism is growing in the beach and it's trying to make itself grow like that, I think it just chose a really bad structure to build itself around on a planet where humans love fire. And I will say that at the very end of the film, watching as Natalie Portman and Kane sort of go off together, the main thing that I was thinking is, don't buy a house with a fireplace. It won't be romantic. But yeah, that's kind of the easiest way that I can make these organisms work, is basically a combination of all three growing in something that's trying to terraform our planet, which explains why the minute that that thing burns away, the shimmer starts to dissipate and the local trees and organisms start to go. I also think it's one of the reasons why none of the organisms are leaving the shimmer. I wonder about, once you're adapted to it, whether or not you can survive outside of it, which doesn't explain how Natalie Portman or Kane do, but it does explain at the beginning why Kane is absolutely breaking down once he gets outside of the shimmer.
Yeah, I was about to say, it shows that he's not doing well outside of the environment.
Right. Multiple organ failure.
Right. It's just, if that was the case, I would expect both of them have died the minute that the terraforming organism is destroyed.
Mm-hmm. In the book, essentially what happens is any person that goes into the shimmer or Area X, that a clone is always made of them, and they come out and that clone dies of cancer, like massive amounts of cancer, almost immediately. And the original individuals all get transformed into some sort of animal or plant. They come across this horrifying skeleton of a woman who's like halfway into a transformation into a massive wild boar, and the skeletons have like aspects of both of them. And
wow,
yeah.
I wish we'd seen more of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I like the subtlety of the organisms we came across. I guess there's not really that much subtle about a bear without a face.
But, yeah.
I like that.
The last way that I can explain all of the changes that we were seeing, and both Adam and Sam are going to give me like faces over it, is nanotechnology. If they had an organism that landed, that basically was existing on a molecular level and changing the environment around it and causing these alterations, basically small machines, then, as the expression goes, any sufficiently advanced technology would be indistinguishable from magic. But that just feels like a giant cop-out for me to say nanotech.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, disregarding the nanotech example, I think most of what you're putting forward has some basis in biological reality, where back a couple billion years ago, I'm not sure exactly when it was, there was something called the Great Oxygen Die-Off, where basically we had a very, to us, toxic atmosphere on this planet that had very little to no oxygen, until some organisms evolved that could fix carbon dioxide, and convert that into oxygen. And as they began to proliferate and spread, the atmosphere switched from being a non-oxygenated one to being full of oxygen, which killed everything that couldn't breathe oxygen. It'd be like if today some plant evolved that drank oxygen and produced more carbon dioxide, so we would all die. But now an entire different group of organisms can evolve and thrive in that atmosphere. So
your
example of the shimmer being this expanding change because of an ecosystem engineer, which is an organism that changes the environment around it, mm-hmm. that can happen. So that's really interesting, I think.
Beavers bring life to rivers and the land. They re-engineer the landscape to create safe habitats for themselves where they can hide from predators and swim to where their food grows.
Okay, so, moving on to a question that I think is really interesting in this movie, because we have brought it up a little bit, but are these good representations of scientists? Kirsty, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I think that they are much more nuanced and complex representations of scientists than we've perhaps been used to seeing, or that I've seen in the past. I think Natalie Portman and Tessa Thompson in particular did a really good job of being complicated people who have relationships and issues. And obviously that's something that I really try and show on the podcast, not necessarily that we all have issues, but that, you know, we have personal lives that inform our scientific decisions. And I think in that sense, they were pretty good portrayals, apart from the things that we have mentioned, like the biologist knows every aspect of biology and so on.
Is there any point at which you were like, because I mean, we talked about the DNA sequencer that Dr. Silver and Wei thought they should have. Is there any other bit of equipment that you were like, why don't they have this with them?
I am a very traditional field biologist. So I'm a write in the rain notebook and a pencil and a clipboard kind of a girl. So you wouldn't find a DNA sequencer in my backpack. Probably some binoculars. And also I did notice that occasionally somebody would get down on the ground and start scraping things into tubes. So I was kind of waiting for a good sample storage system. Yeah, like maybe a little portable freezer or something.
The military does have access because I got reading up on them and I've decided I want them if I get rich. But they have handheld electron microscopes. They're not like perfect, but basically you connect them and then you can actually connect them to your cell phone through like an app system. And I was looking them up last night because obviously you can't look through any receptacle to get that magnification. But if you set this thing up, they're like table bound. They're like this, but I mean, for the listeners, they're about a foot long and you can like stick them in places and then connect them up to your phone and actually generate like really high definition images. Which I was like, oh, that is so cool. They would definitely have one of those.
Yeah, if this is a military-funded operation, I would imagine that funding is no object.
Oh,
portable freezers
point.
Are super expensive. Let alone, electron microscopes and so on.
There's a guy I interviewed a long time ago, Professor Paul Hebert, if you're a... non-francophone, and he is positive that like that Star Trek thing, what's it called?
The tricorder.
They point it. The tricorder. He is positive that that's coming.
Cool.
He is like, this is technology that will be here soon. We can do this.
What do you think?
He's an interesting man.
Some drones would have been useful at some point as well in all of this.
There's a thing that I just want to raise because I think it's an important message, and the book gives the impression, and again, it's a little ambiguous and I might be misinterpreting it, that Natalie Portman's character is just this brilliant scientist, but she can't get grant money because she never really follows through on projects because she's always like, you know, looking for, oh, she finds something new and she's like, no, cool. We should study this instead. Yeah, but it's like, it's this kind of message that she is just, she's got this innate streak of brilliance, which is necessary for being a scientist. Mm. And I hate that message.
Right.
Because anyone can be a scientist if they're curious and they work hard at it. You don't need this like genius level streak that things like movies like Good Will Hunting or
A Beautiful Mind.
I mean, every Sherlock Holmes.
But yeah, the book gives that impression that, you know, you just need this innate streak of brilliance, which is not true. You just need, you know, some sort of curiosity about the world and, you know, a lot of hard work and you can get there. And anyone can do it.
No.
I think for me, my biggest thing is they made a point to say, we've sent in all these military people, they're not coming back, let's send in scientists. But to me, I'm like, that doesn't negate the fact that you would still throw in protection for your scientists.
Yeah.
So like, it's hard for me to believe that they didn't give them like one or two soldiers with them.
They would have sent a science person in at some point. Like there are lots of military science officers, like Spock.
Yeah.
Spock, yeah. Why didn't they send Spock in there, you know?
Or Zachary Quinto being pushed in at the end of it? I just play him on TV.
I'm just a character. okay, so there is one of my favorite bits of this movie is when Lena, Natalie Portman's character, wakes up, they go out, they're like, from our rations, it looks like we've been out here for 2 weeks. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Dave, you have some thoughts about this, right? About the memory loss?
Yeah, and I mean, this is an area where I think Kirsty as well is going to come in handy for keeping me on track. But memory, we're obviously still working on how the idea of memory works. But as like a very quick, short-term how things work, basically you have neurons. Those are the individual cells that make up your brain. and they connect to one another through different pathways. And we think that memory occurs by basically the way that they create strengths associated with those pathways from neuron to neuron to neuron, creates the idea between synaptic plasticity, where formation of memory is basically that fixed image. And the way that we change and alter that pathway is why memory is so plastic. Now, originally, the way that memory works is that you find yourself forming those initial short-term memories in your prefrontal cortex. And then the hippocampus, the big part of the brain that we think of all the time as associated with memory, gets involved and starts basically photocopying those patterns and storing it in such a way that we can get that information under control. Now, if they're walking into some type of altered environment where there's going to be changes associated with local chemistry in the atmosphere, there might be that virus that we're talking about, or there also are properties of radiation, it is going to fuck with that really delicate balance that we need to store memory. And this has been looked at. There's been a whole bunch of really great studies where they found even small alterations in the chemistry that's used by the neurons to create these pathways and store information. If you add in a couple of compounds, you can actually completely stop memory formation or severely alter it. So I worry that basically they've moved in for that first 6 days and the brain has been having a lot of trouble where they're still able to function normally and act normally, but they haven't been able to move that information from the prefrontal cortex into the hippocampus. No long-term memory has been possible. They've basically been walking around with a bad case of memento the entire time. And then as the brain starts to adapt, if there is one great feature that we can say about biological processes, and this does work in the short term, they're really resilient. I wonder whether or not the brain is going to start. There are certain types of cells, microglia, as well as other defensive tissues that specifically can secrete compounds that help to block out things like radiation or better protect DNA. That might step in and basically try to defend the brain in such a way that they can sort of put a patchwork system together and start allowing for memory storage. The same way that people who take brain damage, oftentimes another part of the brain will step in and take over function for a new limb or take over, or sorry, for the old limb or take over a new pathway associated with memory or learning. There is a lot of plasticity associated with the brain. And I wonder whether or not it's shifted over functioning either to one area or it's shifted over the way that it does enough that it can get some memory formation going forward. Now,
I have an alternate theory.
Ooh. You think they're drunk the entire time?
No.
That's when they go in,
this is referencing the book, though, that Sam mentioned earlier. When they first go in, basically they're unconscious and it takes them a couple days to be cloned. And then the clones actually are the one eating their food, and then they just like kind of wake them up in the base camp.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, the other theory that I was just going to go with is the atmosphere has some property that's associated, which is basically making them semi-drunk the entire time, so that like they're just their neuronal pathways aren't working, and then that's why we get some of the bad scientist behaviors where they're basically like, I totally see the genes replicating underneath the microscope. Adam, come look. There they are.
I want to be a plant.
Right. Yeah. Natalie Portman comes around the corner and Tessa Thompson is just standing perfectly still. And she's like, she's trying to do a plant.
Look, I'm one of them.
I'm just a mean green mother from outer space and I'm bay.
Libby, with this stuff that we've talked about, not that everyone being constantly drunk.
Damn it.
But Dave's theory of, you know, viruses and mutagens as opposed to this, you know, like alien intelligence kind of thing. Can you make as suspenseful and like cosmic a movie out of this sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the suspense could still come from even if they're not being changed by going into it. Like, say they have viral protection and hazmat suits and all that stuff. It would be survival because you're still running into those mutated creatures. But figuring out how to stop the expanse. So you're figuring out a way to save the world, essentially. So it's the Armageddon of... I have one question for Kirstie. Since you like plovers, what would a horrifying plover look like for you in this world?
Good question. I think it would have to have like no feathers. like a bald bird because they look so freaky when they don't have feathers, and maybe something like crazy, crazy bill deformation, something like that.
What of your study organisms that you've had before, if you had to merge two of them into one to create a horrifying new animal, what would they be?
I think it would have to have some meerkat traits because they are social and move in groups all the time. So that would immediately magnify the scariness of whatever else was merged with.
Just a massive tribe of them swarming all over Gina Rodriguez. Okay.
Yeah.
After watching your section Alien Planets last night, I was really worried you were going to say a meerkat scorpion, and then I was just not going to have to sleep for a couple of days.
Yeah, that would be good.
I know this is Kirsty's question, but I couldn't help but think of the creatures I've worked with for my research. Now I'm just imagining a frog with like a damselfly or dragonfly's face and its crazy jaw structure, and it's horrifying.
Oh yeah, that would be scary.
Because they dragonflies and damselflies, especially as larvae, have basically the alien xenomorph extendable jaw to grab food, and they are crazy voracious predators that will destroy anything. So if you have a bullfrog-sized dragonfly mouth-equipped amphibian, don't go in the water.
That'd be pretty cool.
To a talking that horrible thing, and then like the lizard meerkat scorpion hybrid, and mine would just be a boring looking fish mixed with a slightly more boring looking fish.
Here's a pike, but it's boring now.
Yeah, a roach and a rudd. Can you tell them apart even if they're not mixed?
Crazy. No, not really.
One has an upturned mouth. This one's is at 90 degrees.
I will say the main thing from living with Sam in Canada that I could see him being terrified of is you've got a Canadian goose and you mixed it with a bear of some sort.
Oh, horrifying. Just the evil of a goose with something the size of a bear. My God.
Mm-hmm.
They would just hang around on campus. Nobody does anything. It's just...
He really hated them. He really hated them.
We'll mix my horrifying creatures with Sam's horrifying goose, which I'm deathly afraid of centipedes. So we could have a centipede goose.
Goose.
A segmented goose, God.
Where's your God now?
We need an artist, yeah. Okay, right. To wrap up, before we've got some really nice fan mail again. I've been contacted earlier this week by Brian Mee from the University of California in San. Oh Christ! There's so many different University of Californias.
Is it UCSD?
UCSD. Yeah.
University of California, San Diego.
San Diego.
Okay. Who got in touch to talk about invasive species and also mentioned that he's started listening to your podcast, Cinematic Animalia, after finding the blog, and I am a fan. I particularly enjoyed, Adam, you'll love this, the episode on parasites, since I quite like parasites myself. Thanks. I think that it is truly remarkable that there are organisms living in an environment that is actively and relentlessly hostile to them.
That's cool.
That's a really good way to think about it.
Yeah, that is a really good way.
Thank you for that.
Thank you very much for tuning in, Brian. Yeah. Okay, well, look, before we go, thank you so much, Kirsty, for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a blast.
No problem. We hope you had fun.
Absolutely.
Yes, there is one last thing. Yes, so I just wanted to say, Kirsty, thank you, Doctor, for coming on. Adam, thank you, Doctor, for being here. Sam, thank you, Doctor, for being here.
God. Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome, Doctor. You're welcome, Kirsty, thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor, for coming on, Kirsty.
You are all welcome, Doctors.
Oh,
fantastic. Adam, do you want to sign us off?
Absolutely. Remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're a biologist. You served in the military.
If I knew what happened, I could save his life.
The boundary's getting bigger. It's expanding. We're talking cities, states.
You need to know what's inside. So do I.
It's beautiful.
Check this out.
It's like they're stuck in a continuous mutation.
Anything interesting in there?
No.
Sharks have teeth like that.
Not possible.
You can't crossbreed different species. What is it?
The soldiers on the last expedition.
They went crazy. Or something in here killed them.
Something's come through the fence.
Through the fence?
We have to go back.
I can't go back.
We can camp here tonight.
Hey! destroying everything.
It's not destroying. It's making something new.